They're gonna kill the love of my life.
Casey!
If I don't go back to what I was doing.
This Friday.
Our line of work is quite brutal and quite ruthless.
How far would you go for love?
You steal truck, bring it to me. Then you make your money.
Is it dangerous?
Of course it's dangerous!
Nicholas Holt, Felicity Jones, with Ben Kingsley and Anthony Hopkins.
All this trouble, all this pain, for love.
Collide, in theaters Friday. Rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Welcome to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals who work with investors, buyers, and sellers of commercial real estate coast to coast. Whether you're an investor, broker, lender, property manager, attorney, or accountant, we're here to learn from the experts.
Welcome, 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 welcome. A little bit of a delay there in the beginning, but we're so glad you could join us. Welcome to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio. My name's J. Darren Gross. I'm a real estate investor and a commercial property insurance broker. I've been an insurance broker for about 25 years, and my primary client base has been real estate investors, landlords, developers, design professionals, and lenders. And based on this, I've continually been looking for more information about real estate and real estate investing for both my own investments as well as so that I can better serve my clients. The result of this has led to the creation of Commercial Real Estate Pro Network and CREPN Radio, where my goal is to have and share in a conversation with experts on topics of interest to commercial real estate professionals and investors. You can find us by Googling Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. You'll find us. We've got a Facebook page, a YouTube page. We've got a LinkedIn group. If you are on LinkedIn, I cannot recommend enough that you go ahead and click in the in the search bar in the top there, type in Commercial Real Estate Pro Network, and you will find our group, and there's an opportunity to join. If you click the top right, I believe it's a yellow button, ask to join, and we'll get you in the group. There's lots of great information in there. We've got there's brokers, wholesale deals, investors, lenders, attorneys, accountants, property managers. Just did a interview last week with a security, video security guy. So just lots of interesting content in there, as well as great people that can answer questions and help you out there. We also have our Twitter handle. It's at CRE Pro Network, and we've got a traditional website, Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. .com. How you can help is if you like what you hear, if you like what we're sharing, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. You can comment, you can like, you can follow, share, share in your network and let everybody know we're out here and the information that you're hearing, I'm sure others can benefit from as well. All right, now that you know a little bit about us and how you can find us, it's time to set up today's program. In business life, in real estate, in all of it, seven days a week, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, there are conflicts that can present themselves. And there's multiple means to resolve contracts. Could be as simple as an apology, might be something a little more involved, refund, maybe payment, all the way to a lawsuit. And one option that sometimes gets overlooked or may not be fully understood is the arbitration. And I'm familiar with that myself from customers I have, construction clients that have contracts that have arbitration clauses and or insurance policies. Actually, many of them contain an arbitration clause, sometimes as an incentive for the parties to agree and or meet and agree, and then maybe there's a lower deductible available through that. But in any case, this is something that's available in many cases. And today we're going to take a look at the pros and cons of arbitration and how you can navigate through arbitration. And to do that, our guest is trial attorney Susan Berlich. She is the principal founder of Susan Berlich PC Law Firm, specializing in trial work. with an emphasis on business and commercial litigation, including the simple and the complex, contract disputes, business torts, breach of fidelity or fiduciary collection, bankruptcy, fraudulent transfer cases, and a broad range of disputes involving real estate litigation, including land use, covenants and restrictions, homeowners association issues, construction litigation and arbitration, title and boundary, commercial and residential real estate foreclosure disputes, and landlord-tenant issues, and also real estate contract disputes involving specific performance, breach and broker commissions, and enforcement matters. Susan is licensed in California and Texas, as well as multiple U.S. district courts and U.S. bankruptcy courts sitting in both states, and she is a member of the American Arbitration Association. She's an arbitrator with the American Arbitration Association. She did her undergraduate work at the Indiana University and got her law degree from University of Houston Law School. With that, I'd like to welcome Susan Berlich to the program. Susan, are you there?
Yes, I am, and good afternoon, Darren, and everyone that is listening. I will start the topic off by talking a little bit about the nature of arbitration and how it's different from another type of dispute resolution, which is called mediation. The question I'm asked more than any other about arbitration through people that may find themselves in the process or be considering it is, isn't this just like mediation? And the answer is no. Arbitration is like a court proceeding. It usually is an outgrowth of a court proceeding or at least an adversarial proceeding of some sort. And the difference between arbitration and being in court in litigation, if you want to simplify it to its very most basic terms, is the fact that you do not go to court, but you have what is in essence a private judge that you pay for, and you proceed to demonstrate the dispute through evidence and defend it the same way you would in court. The only difference being, as I say, you would do this all in an arbitrator's office. An arbitration, nonetheless, even though it's not technically a court proceeding, it is a proceeding that has the authority of law behind it, and the resolution that is reached by the private judge, if you will, the arbitrator, is enforceable in a court of law just like a judgment. The other aspect that I want to talk about generally here at the beginning of this presentation is where you commonly find arbitration clauses in the real estate context. And the answer to that is you find arbitration clauses in almost every real estate contract I could suggest to you, starting with, Darren mentioned construction contracts. Most of the standard construction contracts, the American Institute of Architects contracts, all of these contracts will contain an arbitration clause of some sort. Real estate sales agreements, both commercial and residential, typically will contain arbitration clauses. The listing agreements between a broker and the party, the seller, for instance, will typically have an arbitration clause included. Property management agreements often have arbitration clauses. In addition, some of the commercial leases I've seen have arbitration clauses. And I could go on from there, but I think those are some of the types of contracts that we commonly use, which will basically have an arbitration clause in it from the get-go. If you have a concern about whether you want to arbitrate or not, Obviously, you can negotiate that, you know, with the other party and try to get them to exclude it. But it seems to be more and more commonplace, so I would suggest that anybody involved in any type of real estate transaction look at the arbitration clause, read it closely, and, you know, determine how it is that affects your rights if, in fact, you ultimately do have some type of a dispute. Because typically, if you do sign a contract that has an arbitration clause in it, no matter what the nature of the dispute is, it doesn't simply have to be, hey, look, somebody didn't pay what they were supposed to pay under this contract, or somebody didn't perform under this contract. There can be any number of things that arise out of this relationship that this contract creates, which will require you to go into arbitration if, in fact, the proceeding becomes adversarial and you cannot resolve it outside the context of some type of adversarial proceeding. When you do agree to an agreement that contains an arbitration clause, you also need to make sure that the arbitration clause is broad enough, if you accept it, to cover any various and sundry disputes that might arise. But there are some basic things that need to be in the arbitration clause so that you don't end up having to run back to a court and say, hey, look, this arbitration clause is unclear or confusing, or it does not contain all the information that we need in order to arbitrate this clause. And there's a few fundamental things that it has to say. One, it has to have language, obviously, that says any dispute that arises under this contract or anything related to it is subject to mandatory arbitration. Two, you need to specify where exactly the arbitration is going to be administered. And I will explain what I mean by that. What I mean is that most people have probably heard of the American Arbitration Association. They are no doubt the oldest arbitration association, if you will, that exists. And they're basically an administrator of arbitrations. But in order to get an arbitration going, since you don't want to be in court, you have to file somewhere. And if there isn't some indication as to what arbitration body is going to handle the arbitration, then you're going to have a dispute from the get-go over where you even file, and that's going to set you back. And also, it's going to cost you money because you're going to have a court clarify it. But the American Arbitration Association, even though it's the oldest arbitration association out there, now has quite a bit of competition. There are others. I'm going to name some of the ones that are local here in California, and many of them are also national, but we have here Judicial Arbitration and Mediation Service, also known as JAMS. They are national in scope. Most states have a so-called JAMS office, as well as AAA offices. Here in California, we also have something called Alternative Dispute Resolution Services, and they provide arbitrators in addition to other types of professionals that handle disputes. I could go on, but again, it's become more commonplace in most of the bigger commercial states to have competing private bodies that administer these types of proceedings. And the best thing,
Susan, I got just a real quick, simple question. So a contract would actually specify which of the body of arbitrators you're to use, is that right, as opposed to just an arbitration clause? I mean, when you said where, I was thinking of of jurisdiction, mm-hmm. you know, state or that kind of thing. I wasn't thinking specifics to the body of arbitrators. Is that, are you saying that it's typical that they will specify an actual arbitrator body?
Yes. And they should.
Okay.
Because, as I say, if you have to argue with somebody who already you've picked a fight with over where you're going to file this, chances are they're not going to agree. And if you're the person that wants to advance the dispute, you can't arbitrarily select an arbitration body because the other side might object to it. And if they do, what are you going to do? Then you're going to end up back in court having the court, you know, fill in a term, which is going to cost you money because the court's going to have to hear some evidence on what was intended by the parties. Or I guess they could possibly say, and you certainly don't want this to happen, is the arbitration clause is unenforceable because a critical term has been left out. And so I'm clear, too. It's just you simply need to name an association or organization that handles arbitrations. You do not have to identify the arbitrator. The arbitration body actually handles all that.
Got it.
So,
I'm sorry to mean that.
To your point, though, I think one of the things that definitely ought to be in the arbitration clause as well, and most of them do contain it, is if you are located in a certain place and in the event of a dispute, you want to make sure that dispute is in your backyard, not, you know, 2,000 miles away, you should also identify, even if it's fairly general, this arbitration has to be conducted in Los Angeles County, California, or this arbitration needs to be conducted in Chicago, Illinois, or this needs to be conducted in Portland, Oregon. You can give a city and state that's close enough, and typically the law will say, hey, look, if there's not an arbitration association right in this city, the closest one is the one that is going to have jurisdiction over this. But you definitely should say that or make it clear somewhere else in the contract because, time is money. And even though a lot of the aspects of arbitration are handled now electronically and by telephone, which makes it nice, you still, if you have to show up for a hearing, ultimately you don't want to have to haul all the way across the country. And I've had experience with a number of clients where they signed, you know, they were local, so to speak, to the jurisdiction I was in, and they were working in that locality. But when they ended up in a dispute with the other side, it turned out that the arbitration clause forced them, as I said, to go, you know, far afield, New York City or someplace else, where they never anticipated they would have to go to get the dispute resolved. And, of course, like I say, once it's in the contract, it's very, very hard to argue that that would be unfair.
Right.
So those things are very important to have. Beyond that, I don't like to really complicate it too much. I'm going to talk a little bit later on where if you want to implement certain types of cost-saving devices, you might get into greater detail about, you know, are we going to take depositions? Are we going to do so-called discovery? Or are we going to limit all that? Are we going to say that this arbitration, if it occurs, must be concluded within 6 months after it's filed, which you can do to try to expedite it. But I don't necessarily recommend you get into that much detail because you don't really know what the future is going to hold. But the three things we just talked about, I think, are very important.
Got
so,
it.
Now, from there, I'd like to just talk a little bit about the cost comparisons between arbitration and litigation, and what I really mean is arbitration, that is using a private judge to preside over a case and doing most of the workup either via phone or electronically, is that more cost effective than litigation, which is a formal, full-blown, if you will, court proceeding where you have a traditional judge preside over the case. You have motions that are filed after the case is initiated to try to advance the litigation. And ultimately, if you don't settle it, you have a trial in front of a jury or maybe just in front of the judge. And this has probably been the biggest thorn in the side of arbitration, say, in the latter half of the 20th century, or maybe I should say late 20th century until now, that the various arbitration associations are trying to deal with, because arbitration was initially envisioned as being a process where somebody just filed a simple demand. There's still forms. I may provide some forms here after this is over so that anybody out there listening can take a look at them, but the form the American Arbitration Association uses to initiate an arbitration is still extremely simple. It's a one-page form that just asks you who the parties are, where they are, where you want to arbitrate, how much is in dispute, and that is how much is the claimant, the person initiating, claiming in damages, and to give, you know, a paragraph description of what exactly the controversy is. And that's it. And today you can still initiate an arbitration that simply. The problem is, if it is a problem, arbitration does not just pertain to small matters. In fact, there are vehicles to arbitrate very small matters, but most of the cases that end up in arbitration, you know, can be quite substantial. I mean, involving millions, if not billions of dollars, or even the more commonplace scenario where you've got, you know, $100, $200, $300, $400, $500,000 in controversy are arbitrated all the time. And because sometimes, and maybe more often than not, the issues involved in arbitrations where there's a lot of money at stake can be complicated. And as a result, the parties are certainly not precluded from undertaking a full-fledged adversarial process, which would include, you know, sending, you know, discovery, if you will, requests to produce documents, questions, interrogatories about the other side's theories of their case, sending out subpoenas to third parties for information, records that need to be obtained so that the party that, you know, whatever party that needs it to prove their case or the other party needs it to defend it, can actually do so in the arbitration. Because, again, there's a lot at stake here. It is not an informal process. It's a very formal process that can result in one side or the other getting a judgment against them. And because the nature of so-called discovery can be very time-consuming, it also has, you know, the type of expense that you can incur that a lawsuit would. Also, the arbitrator's powers pretty much equivalent to those of a judge. If, for instance, and some people will argue with me about this, but sometimes parties need what is called an injunction or a restraining order. An arbitrator has the power to give a restraining order, that is to stop somebody from doing something on an ongoing basis that continues to harm one of the parties. Arbitrators can, if they need to, it's really hard, but they can seize assets, or I should say freeze assets, if it looks like somebody is trying to fritter away or dissipate their assets because they've been now involved in an adversarial process. So, again, all that means is that the arbitrator, in order to enter those types of orders, has to take briefing from the parties and has to consider evidence and has to do all the things that take up time in court. So that can be costly for the parties in terms of lawyer time. And arbitration sometimes does not really eliminate that kind of expense. The other issue, of course, is that since an arbitrator is a private judge and not a publicly appointed or elected judge, the parties have to pay the arbitrator for all the time that the arbitrator invests in your case, whether that is offline, reading briefs and trying to educate himself or herself on your case, as well as time spent on the phone with the parties arguing over motions and considering issues in telephonic hearings. So when you look at arbitration in terms of, well, is this going to be more cost effective, I think the answer is still yes in a lot of circumstances, unless you're in a jurisdiction where you really do get the advantage of being able to get your case processed, if you will, quickly in a court. That's going more and more by the wayside. I've practiced in other jurisdictions in addition to where I now practice, which is Los Angeles, which, without disparaging the system, the court system here is just big, and it's notoriously slow because of that. But I've practiced in other major cities, smaller cities, and it does seem that delay just seems to be inherent in the judicial process. There's just all kinds of ways that if a party or parties want to, they can drag their feet, and sometimes even judges who are overwhelmed most of the time with work from other cases can also contribute to these delays. I think you can avoid that in arbitration because I don't find that most arbitrators try to rack up fees. People seem to have this sometimes misimpression that it's just all about the money. I think that people get known in their own jurisdiction, and the people that attempt to take advantage of that are quickly ignored, if you will, or not selected to be an arbitrator. But the parties also have a lot more control over the scheduling of an arbitration than they would in a normal setting before a judge in a court. Calendaring in court, because there are so many uncertainties, can be a very iffy process. And again, in your major cities, the time from actually filing a case to actually getting the case resolved, and I'm talking about resolved whether it settles or whether it goes to trial, I'm going to say a good outcome would be 2 years. And I think, you know, yeah, most people don't consider that good. Nobody.
Not even if you win.
So
not even if you win. I mean, 2 years of your life spent just wrestling with something like that.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't mean to interrupt, but I was just kind of curious what you, and maybe you were going to say this next, was what? How do you find it compares to the arbitration timeline?
Well, an arbitrator gets appointed after an arbitration is filed pretty quickly. And by that I mean, you know, say within 60 days after an arbitration is filed, an arbitrator will have been appointed. It actually happens a lot faster than that, but if the parties don't agree and there's a process that takes place in terms of names of arbitrators are submitted to both sides, and then, you know, they try to agree, and if they can't agree, then it's kind of a random selection process, and that can take up some time. But once that's actually occurs, an arbitrator is selected, and then the parties still have some opportunities to object to get rid of the arbitrator that was actually selected. So there's some built-in delays there, but with a court proceeding, you don't even get a hearing in front of a judge 60 days after you file it. You just don't, because it takes more time usually to get the other side served with papers. The requirements for service are more formal. By the time they answer, there's usually a generous period of time for the other side to respond to it. And then basically the court, after both parties appear, many times they'll set some kind of a schedule, but you won't even get a schedule set for, you know, maybe it'll be within 6 months after you file it. And within that period of time, you're just sitting there, in effect, waiting for a court to act. But with an arbitration, like I say, an arbitrator is usually appointed and you're ready to roll within about 60 days after filing. And they promptly schedule an initial meeting of the parties. That's done by phone. And I keep referring to this, but all the arbitrations I've ever been involved in, either as a part, you know, as counsel for a party or as an arbitrator, hearings are conducted over the phone. So it really doesn't matter, at least at that level, whether, you know, one party's in Miami and the other party's in San Francisco, because the arbitrator is somewhere and everybody is just submitting paperwork to them electronically, and hearings are telephonically held in almost all cases. And that definitely saves money. Plus, arbitrators don't have to. I mean, usually you can't just call the arbitrator and say, hey, look, I need a hearing on something. You have to give the other side notice just like you would in court. But oftentimes the arbitrator is more willing to consider things on short notice as long as the other side doesn't object and it's not a big issue that they really need a lot of time to respond to. That's really hard to do in court. The other thing is, once the arbitrator sets a schedule, which, as I say, you know, I'm being fairly optimistic, but still, it'll be pretty quickly after that first 60-day period passes. And the arbitrator is going to want to lock the parties down at that initial hearing to a certain set of dates. And I've found that it's really more likely that the parties, if they set a pattern of not sticking to those dates, that they really end up causing more delay than the actual process. The arbitrator isn't required to take cases like a judge is, so the arbitrator has to limit him or herself to the number of cases that they can conveniently handle in their schedule. Because when the parties need a hearing, you need to be there. You know, the AAA and some of these other big organizations, they don't mess around and let their arbitrators just determine when it is they're going to be available. They have to make themselves available once they sign on for a case. And I think that's a big difference because, like I say, your judges, they keep getting cases, you know, and they have to handle them all. And they oftentimes find themselves in protracted hearings, and it totally messes up their schedule, and they have to reset things or they have to delay things. But I really do think that that can be largely avoided in arbitration, because it is imperative that an arbitrator act in a more efficient way, because they are working by contract for the parties, and they are not at the whim and call of every case that's assigned to them. So I think that makes a difference. And then finally, when that final hearing is set, and it's going to be set again in this initial hearing before the arbitrator, which will occur, as I say, relatively early on, you know, the parties will typically fight about that. Somebody wants it to occur quickly, and somebody wants it to occur, you know, whenever. But typically, especially, again, with the major arbitration bodies, they don't want to get a reputation that, you know, this case took so long that nobody sees the benefit in doing this. And, again, this isn't just my experience as an arbitrator, but also as counsel for parties that have been in arbitration. You know, most arbitrators aren't going to set a case out more than about a year. And that may seem like a long time as well, but they expect the parties to stick to that because there's a commitment at the front end to do that. And the arbitrator is going to set out a certain amount of time and just block it out. And they're going to say, hey, look, and this week is going to cost you $12,000. And if you cancel this or you don't give me enough notice so I can reschedule it, you're going to be charged for it. And I think that's a pretty big incentive. You know, somebody, you know, there's some flexibility, but people aren't going to want to pay $12,000 is the number I used in this example when nothing happens.
Right.
So I think all of those things do make arbitration a more efficient process. And the arbitrator, again, typically when this initial conference is held, it's not like everybody comes in cold. You know, the parties are going to be directed well in advance to at least try to talk amongst themselves to see what realistically makes sense, to try to get their calendars, you know, synced, if you will, so that they can tell the arbitrator, hey, look, you know, a year down the line, 10 months down the line, whatever, these are the dates that we have that, you know, we can accommodate this arbitration. And they do enforce it. You know, a lot of the times, you know, if there's a good reason for somebody that needs a continuance, I think an arbitrator will grant it. But I don't see continuances granted as freely as they are in court.
In court. Hey, so, I've got a curiosity here. You mentioned in the beginning that, you know, arbitration is a proceeding like court, and I'm just curious. Once you get on the calendar, you mentioned, you know, approximately 60 days to have this initial hearing. The time between the initial hearing and the final hearing or discovery, you know, whatever that process is to gather the information so that you can come and make your case, is it compressed in the arbitration compared to the court, or once you're on the court docket, is the timeline similar, or is that more just a function of the calendar that you just can't control in the court, and that's why it, or one of the things that just continues to stretch it out?
Well, there's going to be a deadline for discovery in either court or in arbitration, but in arbitration, the rules are not as specific as to how much time to allot. And, again, you can set the discovery period for, I think, a much shorter period of time if you want. And then somebody has to come in and say, hey, look, somebody, you know, said something to me in a deposition, and this was a big surprise, and it was totally different than what they told me their case was about. Now I need another month because I need to take two or three more depositions or whatever. I mean, the arbitrator will entertain excuses like that. But typically up front, I mean, you know, from the initial discussion or initial hearing that's held in the arbitration, you know, you can expect maybe, you know, 120 days, you know, maybe 150 days allowed for discovery from that point. But I think, you know, 5 months after the first hearing in arbitration is held, to allow for discovery is probably plenty for most cases.
Got it.
And again, you have control over it, you know. And people play games, of course, but, you know, if the other side says I need a year and a half for discovery, the arbitrator is going to say why. You know, another thing I guess I'd throw out for whatever it's worth, but most arbitrators now, when that initial conference is held, will require the parties to produce you know, documents that are material without even having to force either side to send out a formal request. And that's different than most state courts, for sure. And that should save time because he's going to put or she's going to put the parties on the spot and say, hey, look, you know, you're disputing, say, this contract on this basis. You're saying, you know, this person didn't perform, and you're saying, well, you know, I'm not going to pay until they perform. You know, tell me, you know, you need to exchange documents that show that that there wasn't performance. You know, in a construction contract, that's pretty easy. You know, did they walk off the job, or, you know, do you have, you know, logs that show that actually work was done on a certain day and somebody signed off on it and the project or your part of the project was completed? I guess all my point is there's going to be basic stuff. You know, if somebody sells somebody something and it wasn't paid for, it's like, okay, everybody exchange the invoices, exchange copies of the checks that showed that you pay. My point being is that all of this basic information that is reduced to, you know, some type of document or other, the arbitrator is typically going to require that the parties voluntarily provide the other side with it right up front. So that saves time right there. And I've also seen in a lot of cases, you know, you can take depositions, which is to get people under subpoena, so to speak, and, you know, ask them a lot of questions before they actually testify. I mean, any case, you can always think of a dozen people, in some cases dozens of people who ought to be deposed. Again, typically, even where there's a fair amount of money involved, an arbitrator has the power and usually will say, hey, look, you know, party one, how many depositions do you think you're going to take? Party two, how many depositions do you think you're going to take? And, you know, if it's some outrageous number, that number I can almost guarantee you will be limited because the arbitrator will have read the papers and say, you know, this doesn't make any sense to me. I'm going to limit it, you know, three depositions per side. And if you need any more than that, you're going to have to come back to me and then justify why it is you need to take more. And that's also very effective. Depositions are very expensive. They're very time-consuming. You know, it's debatable sometimes as to what the necessity is, depending on the importance of the party that's being deposed. But it's, I think, another way where you really can control your costs in arbitration, and most arbitrators will assist you in doing so by limiting discovery to what the arbitrator perceives as being reasonable based on just their reading of the paperwork.
Now, it's interesting to hear you speak just about the control that the arbitrator has to kind of be reasonable, you know, as opposed to, I mean, I've been, well, I've seen numerous claims and you know, whether they start out reasonable or they go off the deep end. But the at some point, I think people get lost in the fact that you have to be able to prove whatever it is you're alleging, which kind of coincides with what you're speaking to, is that a reasonable person, the arbitrator, is going to take the information and come to a conclusion based on what's been presented. I'm amazed at how many people I've seen don't seem to understand that at some point, you know, either A, you've got to prove this, and B, there's a reasonable outcome. You know, somebody's going to make a determination, unless you're going to court. You know, like you said, where all sorts of other things can happen, but just that there is this the burden of proof, I guess, is that the legal term there. You have to be able to prove mm-hmm. that you've been injured, and then what's a resolution to that? How many zeros are there involved, or whatever that is? I'm just looking here on some of the things that you had provided here. I was going to ask you. You mentioned in the very beginning, and I don't want to throw a curve here. So tell me if that's not a good time to talk. But so arbitration and court proceeding are essentially on equal footing as far as their outcome. Is that correct?
Yes. Because what happens is that the arbitrator ultimately makes a decision. The arbitrator puts that decision in writing. That decision becomes final, although if there's any money involved in terms of one side is determined to have damaged the other side and the arbitrator gives a money award, usually there's a period of 30 days that the party who has to pay this award has to get it paid. If they don't get it paid within that period of time, that is 30 days after the award is made, then the party to whom the award was made just files an application with the state court, or it could be filed with a federal court. Most of them, again, there's exceptions, but most of them are filed in state court to have a judgment entered on the arbitration award. And that is a simple process compared to everything that precedes it, because a judge really does not have any discretion, if you will, about whether a judgment will be entered on that award. The party that loses the arbitration, so to speak, can come to court and raise objections, but most arbitrations, either by law or contract or both, are non-appealable. And the arbitrator has the last word. And the law has developed that the grounds for appealing an arbitration award, or in the first instance, trying to prevent a judgment from being entered on it, they're just minuscule. There's hardly any way to get an award set aside. I mean, you actually have to show that the arbitrator was corrupt in the sense that, he was being paid or she was being paid under the table, or there was some kind of fraud, you know, there was some backroom deal cut that one of the parties wasn't privy to, or the arbitrator unfairly precluded somebody from putting on evidence. But even at that, I mean, the arbitrator has so much control over what evidence can come in that the instances of an arbitrator being reversed because they didn't hear the whole case are very few and far in between. So there just aren't that many grounds. It's not like you can retry or rehear the case in front of the judge. The judge just doesn't have any ability to do that.
So it's not like the appeals process in the court. It's a binding arbitration, and that's it, unless, you like you said, there's some sort of a cause for fraud or whatever that, you know, may have been, but it sounds like it's pretty rare.
Well, it is rare.
Yeah. Curiosity had me. So in the very beginning, you mentioned that the process, equally binding arbitration to a court hearing. Mediation, you brought that up in the beginning, and I hadn't even thought about that. What's, if you can, we've got a few minutes here. Is mediation ever enter into these types of disputes, or is that a whole nother vehicle for resolution? Or,
well, the answer is yes.
Okay.
But I want to distinguish the two up front. All mediation is just what it sounds like. It's a what I call a structured settlement conference or structured settlement talks where, you know, somebody goes out and hires a mediator, and that's, again, a person that may or may not have some training in how to negotiate, basically, or try to help parties settle disputes. And you get all the parties together at an appointed place and time, and then you get this mediator who essentially acts as an impartial negotiator, is the best way I can describe it. You know, somebody who doesn't have a stake in the outcome and doesn't have any incentive to, you know, decide anything because they don't really know a lot about all the evidence that's gone on. It presumably doesn't have much of a relationship, you know, with the parties and doesn't, as I say, know a whole lot about what gave rise to the dispute. That is the facts. But somebody that's kind of trained in human psychology and negotiation and can counsel both sides, if you will, about what's good about their case, what's bad about their case, but ultimately get them to see the case more from a third party's perspective. And possibly, I mean, they're not there to tell anybody how to resolve it. All it is, like I say, it's just an informal way to get the parties to talk about settlement, and a mediator doesn't have any power to really do anything.
Gotcha.
You know, they can't make a resolution of the case. They can't force any party to settle. They're just there to – they're like a facilitator for settlement purposes. But if the parties – don't reach an agreement on their own with the assistance of the mediator, then that's the end of the story. The mediator doesn't have any power to do anything. If they do, the mediator, you know, can kind of assist them to make sure that all the I's are dotted and T's crossed on the material terms of the settlement agreement. But again, that's largely left to the parties to document at some point before, hopefully, the mediation is over. And it's usually, of course, a shorter process. You know, mediations, they can last, you know, a long time if anybody really wants them to, but the average time period that mediation occurs is about a half day or a day. Sometimes in a really big case, it might go 2 or 3 days, but again, the mediator is not hearing any evidence during this time period. All he or she is trying to do is get the matter resolved and lend a more neutral perspective to the party's dispute. So
got
that's
it.
That distinction. But does it enter into arbitration? Yes, I think mediation in this day and age enters into every adversarial process that exists out there. you know, most of the time an arbitrator will, in that initial conference, determine whether or not the arbitrator is going to order the parties to mediate. And the arbitrator can also assist them in the selection of a mediator if they don't agree, or can simply advise the parties to agree, but that mediation has to be accomplished sometime before the ultimate final hearing in the arbitration. So mediators can assist in that way. And I don't want to muddy the waters too much by even bringing this up, but more and more, again, in the real estate context, a lot of your real estate contracts of any, you know, variety that we've talked about also make mediation mandatory. And if it's in the contract, if you're forced to arbitrate and it's in the contract that you have to mediate, then you have to mediate. And sometimes, and again, more frequently in real estate contracts, you will also find that you have to mediate before either party can pull the trigger and go file an arbitration. And again, it doesn't have to be successful, but you just have to be able to show that you did it.
Got it. Well, I appreciate you making that clarification there, because it dawned on me for a minute there that you know, a lot of times I kind of run down that path thinking one, but I may be thinking of the other, and just kind of the clarity in the channel or the sequence, if you will, and how it happens there. We've got just a couple of minutes here left, and I wanted to give you a chance to. If there was any kind of a summary to this you'd like to offer, and then also ways for or the listeners to get in touch with you if they had any questions or wanted to seek your advice.
Okay, great. Well, I wanted to just throw out a couple other pointers because I've talked, I hope, pretty generally about a lot of different issues already, but. A lot of times arbitration has been seen as desirable because the process is different in another way from a court proceeding, in that everything that happens in court is typically public record. And there's, again, you know, practically no exceptions to that. When individuals or companies get sued, a lot of times, you know, why would they want somebody to know about that? And if you're in the kind of business, and I think, you know, real estate, there's a lot of aspects of it where, you know, things sometimes just don't pan out right. And you ought to always be at least mindful that, hey, look, this deal could fall apart. This project could go south. This construction might not get completed. Somebody's going to go broke. You know, there's any number of things
sure.
that can happen, and especially over contracts that take place over a long term. So, you know, you have to be concerned about that. And if you're in a high risk, or even if you're just in business these days, you know, it's easy to get sued for not very much. So I think the good news is, like I say, because I think people don't want to necessarily have to air all their dirty laundry in a public forum, and because lawsuits are kind of, you know, for better or for worse, a fact of life in this day and age, the confidentiality that arbitration affords parties that become adverse is really a good thing. Again, you know, sometimes, you know, it's not perfect, but for the most part, because the scope of the arbitrator's authority is large, you really can keep a court almost entirely out of your dispute until you have to have a judgment entered. And as I say, it doesn't take a whole lot to get the court to enter judgment. So the proceeding, for the most part, and the evidence that comes in and the people that testify and the things that they say are going to remain confidential.
No, that's pretty valuable to know. And I would think that that would drive anybody has the opportunity to control a contract to push for that. You know, and besides all the benefits of the speed and efficiency you mentioned.
Yeah, and the only other thing, too, just in terms of trying to dispel myths, because, you know, the American Arbitration Association and JAMS and probably some of the others, but those two I know, they've got a bunch of statistics that they've developed because some people fear arbitration because they don't think they're going to get a fair shake because the arbitrator just splits the baby. You know, that's the thinking
right.
on this. In other words, you know, whatever the claimant throws out there, the arbitrator is just going to divide it down in by two, and that's all the thought that'll go into the process. And, you know, that's absolutely not true. You know, it's not one-sided plaintiff. It's not one-sided defense. And in terms of money that's awarded, if any, I mean, many arbitrations are like court cases. The claimant just fails. They fail to prove their case. But the amount of money, to the extent they've been able to look at what the claims were, if it's awarded, is not just split down the middle. The statistics totally refute that. And that's true, as I say, in terms of the large number of cases that have been handled by the bigger arbitration bodies. So it's about as fair as it can be. It's as fair, I think, certainly as going to court.
Got it. Well, Susan, you want to give some contact information here for you? What's the best way for somebody to get in touch with you if they'd like to reach out to you for your services?
You know, I will give you, first of all, my website, because my website has all my up-to-date contact information on it. And my domain name is Barilich Law. It's Barilichlaw. So www.barilichlaw.com. My phone number is 818-500-0377. And again, that's 818-500-0377. My email is Susan, S-U-S-A-N, at Barilich Law, again, the domain name, .com. So Susan at BARILICHLAW.com.
Hey, great.
But the website has it all.
No, that's, thank God for
more
website.
More info about me, too. So.
That's great. Hey, Susan, I want to say thank you again for taking some time to talk to us today. I'm sure the listeners will find a lot of useful information in this, and I've learned a lot. You know, it's something I run into all the time, but just the ability to speak to my customers and then also emphasize the benefits I hadn't understood before about the arbitration is very, very helpful. And again, I want to say thank you for providing that. And with that, I'd like to just say if you're open to it, again, in the future, I'd love to have you back and dive into some more law talk. I know it is an element that exists in real estate and seems to happen more and more.
Sure.
So, all right.
I enjoyed being here, and thank you for asking me.
You got it. You got it. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up here. Remember, you can find us, Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. You can find us on Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn. I can't stress enough, if you're on LinkedIn, go ahead and consider joining the group, Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. Look for us on Twitter at CRE Pro Network and CommercialRealEstatePronetwork.com. Remember, like, follow, share, comment.
We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, thanks for listening to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network and CREPN Radio.
You're listening to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals. For more information on this or any of our guests, like us on Facebook, CREPN Radio.
Life is full of big moments. Getting married, having kids, moving into a new home. These are the kind of moments that change everything. And they might have you making changes to things you don't always think about, like your health coverage. Covered California wants you to know that when you have a big life change, you may be able to enroll in health coverage or adjust your current plan. The enrollment window is limited, so to see if you qualify or to find one of our local experts, visit coveredca.com today. Covered California. It's more than just healthcare. It's life care.